From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Could tomorrow decide who will be the Democratic presidential candidate, or will it be a moment where no matter what the results, both candidates will fight on? Ohio, Texas, Rhode Island, and Maine hold political contests tomorrow. Texas and Ohio are blue-collar states that used to be seen as sure wins for Hillary Clinton. But recent stats show Obama has narrowed the lead to nearly a dead heat. For more now, we've got NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hey, Ron.
Hello, Farai.
So, first of all, polls aren't everything, but what are they showing?
The polls are showing it too close to call, really, in both states, in both Texas and Ohio. But having said that, there's a little bit more to be gleaned from these polls. In Texas, Barack Obama has erased a 20-point lead for Hillary Clinton from, say, several weeks ago, right after Super Tuesday, and actually taken a small lead on average. Taking all the polls together, he seems to have a point or two advantage. That's not statistically significant, but it does suggest that he has caught her, that it is close enough for him to represent well in the primary voting during the day tomorrow. And we'll talk in a moment about the caucuses that are coming up in the evening tomorrow. But he should hold his own in that primary voting during the day. And that may be the one most significant sentence to say about the March 4th primaries. Over in Ohio, still looks like Clinton country. Most of the polls showing her still with some small advantage. It's statistically not that significant, but there is one poll out, the Ohio poll from the University of Cincinnati, that still shows her up about 10 percentage points. That would tend to indicate that she is going to pull out Ohio.
Ohio was this real bellwether last election, and it's been a bellwether many times, but Ohio was the make or break state last time around in the general election. What makes Ohio special in terms of what it represents for America?
Ohio almost always votes with the winner. Ohio votes for the man or the woman, perhaps the 2008 case, who winds up winning the presidency. So Ohio has a diversity that is representative of the country in terms of North and South, urban and rural, white and black and Latino. It has a blue-collar, white-collar mix that reflects the country. It's a kind of microcosm for the whole 50 states.
When you think about all of the issues that are swirling around this election, this primary season, superdelegates and earned delegates and brokered conventions, is tomorrow really the moment of truth, or is it just another moment?
It's potentially the moment of truth. And more than any Tuesday or Saturday that we've had thus far in 2008, this date has the potential to close it out. For example, on the Republican side, John McCain is almost surely going to go past the magic number of 1,191 delegates, and he will become the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. Could that happen on the Democratic side? No. Nobody is going to go over the magic number needed to nominate on the Democratic side. For one thing, it's about twice as large a number. They just are going to have lots more delegates to get this thing resolved. What could happen, at least in theory, is that Barack Obama could win Texas and Ohio if he pulls off something of an upset in Ohio. Vermont as well, probably not Rhode Island, but let's say he throws in Rhode Island too and just adds that to this big long string of 11 victories he's already put together. And if that were to happen, by whatever narrow margins, it really wouldn't be of consequence what the margin was. If he were to win all of these events, then I think most everyone in the Democratic Party who was not a hardcore Hillary Clinton partisan would have to say, look, he's wrapping it up. There's really no point in Hillary Clinton going on. He keeps winning. He's got the delegates. He's going to have the delegates. There's really no point in Hillary Clinton continuing. So in that sense, there's the potential for a knockout blow on March 4th. What's more likely is that he's just going to solidify his position of being the front runner in pledged delegates, but there will be other issues to resolve. Superdelegates, what do you do with Michigan and Florida? Whether or not the Pennsylvania primary might be brought into, in some sense or another, reverse the momentum. There will be other issues to discuss if it's a split decision on March 4th.
What, if anything, changes for Senator McCain if or when he just absolutely is carried over in terms of the delegates that he has?
Well, he can start being nice to Mike Huckabee again, because Mike Huckabee will pretty much have to pull out. He has said that he expects to continue his campaign beyond this Tuesday, and he expects to go all the way to the Republican convention in the Twin Cities. But look, he has also on other occasions said once John McCain gets to the required number of delegates, then it really is feckless. And I think Mike Huckabee will see it that way a little later on this week and pull out. John McCain can then set his own campaigning schedule. He can focus himself on resolving some of his disputes with the Federal Election Commission over some of the fundraising issues and the issues of whether or not he is taking public financing that he needs to resolve. And he can devote himself full time to trying to placate those elements of the Republican Party, primarily social conservatives, who have been unhappy with his nomination.
Before we let you go, just give us a quick taste of what seems like a bit of a surf and turf approach in Texas, where there's a caucus and a primary. How does that work?
They call it the Texas two-step. During the day, there is a normal primary any of us would recognize, and two-thirds of the delegates are allocated on the basis of that. Two-thirds of the delegates are going to be responsive to the results of that primary. Then at night, starting 15 minutes after the polls close in each county in Texas, they have caucuses. They call them conventions. We would normally see them as caucuses. And at those caucuses, they allocate another third of the total number of delegates, and Texas has 193 pledged delegates to allocate tomorrow. So that's going to be important too, and those dynamics usually tend to favor Barack Obama as they have in other states. So that's why I think most people are expecting Barack Obama to come out of Texas tomorrow with more delegates in that state than Hillary Clinton.
Well, Ron, as always, great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Farai.
Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor, and he spoke with us from Washington, D.C.
Have the power to do that, unless he's convicted of a crime and found to be guilty of that crime. And it is having an effect on the city already, because you have a National Council of Black Mayors. They have pulled out of Detroit for their convention next month.
That's a very profound statement. Do you think
Yes.
that it's just essentially repudiating the city until the city is a symbol for good governance?
Oh, definitely, because the leader of that group, he gave the reason for them pulling out of the convention here in Detroit, which was supposed to take place, I think, the middle of April. He specifically said because of the troubles the mayor is having, that's why they decided to go elsewhere, and they would be going to New Orleans, Louisiana. And that's a testament to the lack of effectiveness the current mayor has in Detroit right now. You have people taking money out of the city that the city so dearly needs. That's a sign that it's time for him to go. Originally, I was not for him resigning. My thing was let everything play out. But when it starts to affect the city, a city that is in dire straits of the need to have money come into the city and be spent in the city, have people invest in the city, that's a problem. And I don't have faith in the electorate in Detroit to not do the right thing in 2009.
Well, you know, Mr. Brown, I think it says a lot about, you know, the folks who are in power, that once they get there and something like this happens, you know, they want power so much that they'll just cling and hang on until the very end, when, as you pointed out, man, this thing is affecting the city.
Correct.
You know, if the laws aren't in place, then the laws need to be changed, that, you know, to get this kind of stuff out of there. I mean, the sex stuff is bad enough as it is. And, you know, even as bad as that is, I would even argue that, hey, maybe that's not the reason for them to step down. But when it's just so much corruption and cover-up going on, I mean, that's just not good. And, yeah,
right.
the sex stuff is bad, point blank.
And the story that was done on Nightline last week, I mean, that really put everything into perspective with people around the country, because a lot of people may not have been aware of this, but a lot of people did watch Nightline last Wednesday or Thursday. And the comments that are on the Nightline website right now, I mean, if you are from Detroit, you should be ashamed to say or tell anyone you're from Detroit.
And see, the thing is, you know, we talk about, you know, the first black person to do this, first black, and Kwame is not, but it just shows you that, hey, you know, let's not put too much stock in the first black or having a black person in a certain position when you're not going to hold up and represent like you need to.
Jasmine, let me throw you into this mix. That's something that comes up again and again. It's like, are you down with the Brown just because of loyalty, or do you need to hold people to as high or even a higher standard? I mean, black elected officials are always going to be scrutinized closely from outside and inside the community. In a case like this, what's the responsibility of the voters?
The responsibility of the voters is to obviously do what they need to do to move the city forward. And it sounds like the mayor needs to go. It sounds like he stopped serving the public interest, is now serving his own personal interests. We always have to hold our elected and public officials accountable. I think you're seeing a nationwide movement of that with CBC members who are trying to support Clinton, even though their districts have said, hold up, no, we want Obama. And they're being, you know, called out for that, and rightfully so, because the districts, their constituents who they were elected to represent, you know, is the voice that they should be listening to. And the same goes here. While I don't know too much about what's going on in Detroit, it sounds like I said, he's serving his own personal interests. And we've had a situation or two like that here. Compton and Linwood come to mind, you know, where we've had sort of the same situation going on.
Well,
I'll find a point for right.
Please go ahead.
The thing is, it's not about the text messages. It's not about the sex and cheating on his wife. For me, it's about the fact that he tried to have a secret deal to prevent this information from becoming public. That's what I have a problem with.
Which is no different from our federal government, right? And when we found out that our federal government was doing that with certain things as it related to the war and other things, you know, all hell broke loose. And we demanded that certain files be, you know, open so we could find out what's going on. So, again, it sounds like this man really needs to go.
Correct. But, you know, look what we have here, the infidelity, the text messages and all that kind of stuff. You know, the secret deal is one thing, but then you marry that with, you know, the infidelity.
Well, Bill Clinton, we had President Clinton. I don't think that's a reason to oust an elected official. But when you talk about cover-ups in the millions and millions of dollars and things of that sort, I think that's when it's time to reanalyze and figure out whether a person
No. Point taken. But my thing is, you know, if you put those two together, you see clearly the type of person that you're dealing with, the type of person who will try to make a sweet deal, a backroom kind of deal, is the kind of person who was doing these other things on the side.
All right, guys, I want to move us.
$9 million that they did not have.
I want to move us on to one last topic, but first of all, in case anyone's tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're talking with Jasmine Kanick of jasminekanick.com, Eric Brown of the Detroit News' political and government blog, and John McCann, who runs the blog Book of John. We were just talking about Detroit, and it sounds like there's plenty there, but I want to just take a quick journey to Neverland. Neverland Ranch, Michael Jackson. He has missed payments on a $24.5 million loan for his amusement park / ranch / boudoir. And one question that comes to mind for me is, should his family, given that he has exhibited some unusual behavior, should his family have stepped in? Would anything have been different? Did they try? Jasmine, what's your sense of that?
I really don't know. I mean, are you talking about like a Britney situation where
kinda
her father had to step in? I mean, the man is a grown man. You know, when I first, you know, heard the story, I thought to myself, well, okay, there are tens of thousands of other Americans out there who are missing payments on their home loans, too. That, you know, we're in a crisis right now in America. And I guess, you know, maybe, you know, he's not above that crisis either. But at the end of the day, it was probably poor financial, you know, management. If I had as much money as Michael had, I would not even be in this situation. But then on the second hand, I wouldn't even own a piece of property that big, not one that I don't visit either.
Well, John, the question becomes, I mean, many people have looked at the trials that he went through regarding possible inappropriate behavior with children, all of the different issues that he's had over time. And you can't control another adult all the time, but there are checks and balances that often go around the lives of entertainers, you know, managers and other people who are trying to steer their ships. Is this a case where he just did what he was going to do, or do you think other people maybe even benefited from what sounds like poor decision making?
Well, first of all, cue up some sappy violin music for me now. I don't know about all.
You're
that.
Not sobbing for Michael.
No. Actually, I am. Actually, I am, and I'm disgusted. Hint, hint. Miss Jasmine, because listen, you know, this is just flat out wrong.
You disgusted at me?
Yeah, because listen, this is Michael Jackson we're talking about here. Look at all this man has
done. You better
done
beat it
for America. He gave us the moonwalk. He had us drinking Pepsi and wearing Jerry curls. The American people need to step up and respond and
bail out.
Government
need to bail him out too.
We need to bail him out.
Okay.
Yeah. John, you alone on that one, on, John, I think you plan on performing on Def Jam next week.
You better beat it.
I'm hating on Michael Jackson, man.
I'm not hating on him. I agree with Jasmine. He's a grown man. I have brothers and a sister. If I'm not aware of their financial situation or if they don't let me into that situation, it's hard for me to get in a position to help him out because he seems to have more people that do not look like him around him more so than his own family.
Uh-oh.
So, bam, there you have it.
Except when he got into legal trouble, then he had
that's
the
fruit
of Islam.
That's when he wanted to come home. He wanted to be, he wanted to be Michael Leroy Jackson. But bottom line is,
exactly.
You deal with people the way you want to deal with your people, and I don't have any sympathy for him.
Not
when you have that much money.
I agree. When you have that much money, this is just absolutely ridiculous for him to be in this sort of situation. And maybe it'll teach him a lesson, maybe it won't. Regardless of the fact, he will still be Michael Jackson. I'm sure he will still put out albums. But, I guess it just goes to show you that even with all the money in the world, you can still have problems. Look at Britney, look at Michael, look at all of these celebrities who are sort of in this sort of financial trouble.
Same situation.
We're going to have to end it there. More money, more problems. Thanks,
right.
Guys. We've been talking to Jasmine Canik, political commentator who blogs at jasminecanik.com, Eric Brown, who blogs for the Detroit News' political and government blog, and John McCann, who runs the blog Book of John. And that is our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, more than 2 million people are behind bars in the United States. How our record-high prison population is disproportionately affecting the African American community. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.
Support for NPR comes from John and Catherine Debs, funding the Bay Area Women's and Children's Center, providing service to low-income families at bawcc.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
NIMBY. It's an acronym for Not in My Backyard. When it comes to low-income housing in middle-class neighborhoods, NIMBY can become a community slogan. But does low-income housing have to look like low-income housing? That question was tossed around in the halls of the Institute of Classical Architecture, or ICA. The New York-based group got together with the home builders Habitat for Humanity, and together they came up with blueprints for homes that would fit into the neighborhoods and not stick out like many low-income homes do. Paul Gunther is president of the ICA. He joins me now from our New York Bureau. And Detrika Brown is a single mom. This past weekend, she moved into her new Victorian-style home. It's in the historic Thomas Square Streetcar District of Savannah, Georgia. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello.
So, Detrika, congratulations. How was this whole moving in and the ceremony?
Oh, it was wonderful. We had a good time. A lot of people came out and congratulated me. It was just a wonderful event. I was very excited.
Now, Habitat has this model of putting in a lot of sweat equity and contributing to the cost of the house. What did you actually have to do to get this house in terms of, you know, your own labor, your own money, all that?
Well, I did put in a lot of hours of labor. We had to do 350 hours of sweat equity. I did a lot more hours than the 350 because I was out there all the time, you know, especially when they got to my house. So I was out there seeing how everything was going, helping out as much as I could because I know it was a lot of volunteers that did, you know, they came out. And during the month that was slow was during the holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas. So I went out there whenever I could.
Tell us about your kids and what kind of place you were living in before.
Okay, we stayed on the south side of Savannah. It was a pretty all right neighborhood, but then it kind of got bad after a while. Kids was breaking in. It was kind of overcrowded out there, and I was renting, so it definitely wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to always be a homeowner, so that's what I put in my mind to do, and I got it done thanks to Habitat.
So, Paul, this collaboration, describe to me what the home that Detrika moved into looks like. What, you know, some people are familiar with Victorians, if you've lived in San Francisco, for example, but, you know, what's that style mean in this case?
It respects, there's two things that go on in Habitat. They, of course, are above all sheltering individuals. And your preceding interview reminded me that in a funny way, Habitat is taken on the role of some of these communities as the proverbial local banker, because unlike some of the recent activity with mortgages, they actually scrutinize these homeowners and help them make sure they can meet their needs. It's quite an interesting passing of the baton in that respect. But this is a neighborhood in Savannah. Savannah's had a great redevelopment and rebirth the last 20 years. The Victorian wooden houses in the neighborhood are marvelous. They were respected perhaps less. It followed the interest in the grid section of Savannah. And this house is a simple wood frame Victorian house, not much decoration in line with the budgets of Habitat, but a nice, solid, well-proportioned Victorian house that I think graces its context beautifully.
So when you mentioned that it doesn't have a lot of decoration, some of the Victorians, the classic Victorians, are known for being really ornate and sometimes being painted in these outrageous ways. But it sounds like the house still has good bones.
I'd be curious to hear what Detrika thinks so far.
Yeah, what do you think?
But I think so.
Yeah, Detrika, what do you think?
Yes, it does have. It's a very sturdy house. It's, you know, made out of good pine wood, and I mean, it's hurricane ready. It actually, it looks just like all of the other houses in the neighborhood. I mean, so it doesn't sit out like a thorn or anything. It really blends in well with the neighborhood.
And how many bedrooms does it have? Because you've got a 15-year-old and a 9-year-old. Do each of you get your own bedroom?
Yes, it's 3 bedrooms, 2.5 baths, 2-story.
Fantastic. Now, Paul, when you think about bringing good architecture to affordable housing, what's the history been? I mean, how has affordable housing looked in this country, and what are you trying to do that's different?
Well, of course, the history of affordable housing is an extraordinarily complex one in Europe, around the world, and in America. And the Institute is a school. It's a membership organization. It's based in New York, but in fact, it operates across the country via regional chapters. And we're not pretending for a second we're the first ones to think about this. Others have endeavored to do it, other NGOs, Habitat certainly. But we try to take a national approach to come up with a systemic, model-based system that other affiliates and chapters could follow. So that's I want to stress the sort of inherent humility in all of this. It's just that, urban centers have been abandoned, the subdivisions in the suburbs have spread out, the neighborhoods have sort of disintegrated, and now that Habitat and other NGOs are thinking more about urban infill, they are encountering NIMBY, as you stated at the outset, and greater concern for not only the individual structure but the surrounding community that would result. And so by de facto or by necessity, they have to think about these issues. And I think other communities are too. So I guess the bottom line there is, as we think about today in the 21st century moving back in, and with the promise of cities, I know some people are conjecturing now that the fringe suburb will it be the sort of new ghetto, if you will, because of the cost of fuel and the problem with obesity, that indeed people are looking back to the city. And I hope we're at the vanguard of trying to help those with lesser means to not only build in the city but to enhance the community along the way, just as Deirdre said her house seems to do, which is very good news indeed.
And when it comes to something like this, you gather together a lot of different financial partners and foundations, and you're looking at doing different models but the same concept in other parts of the country. Give me quickly just one example of what you might be looking to help design
and
build.
another one of the prototypes in our program was in Rochester, New York, which has a very dynamic Habitat affiliate. And they called it 10 Doors from History because it's 10 doors down from the Susan B. Anthony House, which is a federal landmark. And in fact, it can be said, besides Seneca Falls, New York, really the cradle of suffrage, women's suffrage in America. So it's this incredibly interesting neighborhood. It's very, it's solid, it's mixed, it never really went down completely. On the other hand, it's had some tough times. So in that case, it's a more restrained, I guess you'd say, federal-style house, which was what Greek Revival even, but again, very restrained because that was the more predominant vernacular in downtown Rochester, New York at the time of that neighborhood. So you have a contrast with the Victorian prototype in Savannah.
Well,
let me
get
Dietrich. It's a big deal. It's right there at this incredibly important place in American history, and now a single woman has a beautiful home, and the neighborhood's very pleased with the result.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask how pleased you are, Dietrich. I mean, how do you feel about your neighbors? Just like, do you think that you guys are going to learn to get along and hang out and not just be side by side, but also have some kind of heart connection?
Oh, well, my neighbors are wonderful. I've met all the neighbors in the neighborhood. I mean, they don't treat me any different. I mean, when I see them, we speak, we chit-chat a little. I mean, we get along fine.
And you're looking forward to this?
Oh, yes, I love it. I already love it. I mean, the house is wonderful. The neighborhood is wonderful. Habitat is definitely wonderful because they give, gave me this experience, and I'm just a blessed person, very blessed.
All right. Well, Dietrich and Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dietrich Brown is a single mom and a new homeowner living in the historic Thomas Square Streetcar District of Savannah, Georgia. And Paul Gunther is president of the Institute of Classical Architecture and Classical America, ICA for short, and he joined us from our New York bureau. For more on the ICA's Book of Designs and to check out photos of Dietrich's house, go to our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On our Bloggers Roundtable today, another first for black politicians, plus an L.A. mortgage company tells pop star Michael Jackson to hand over his house keys and beat it. Joining me now on the roundtable is political commentator Jasmine Canik of jasminecanik.com, Eric Brown, who blogs for the Detroit News' political and government blog, and John McCann, who runs the blog Book of John. Hey, folks.
What's going on?
How are you doing?
I am doing great. So let's talk about Karen Bass, a L.A. native elected last Thursday to head California State Assembly. She is the first black woman to ever take the speaker position, and here she is accepting her new title.
It is a coincidence that this vote coincided with the planned celebration of African American History Month, but it is a wonderful coincidence because I have always been aware that I am here today because I stand on the shoulders of those who came before, those leaders and trailblazers that we will pay tribute to today. We are all bracing ourselves for the crisis that we face in our state, and I look forward to spending my time as your next speaker. It's going to take me a while.
Now, California generates 17% of the nation's economic revenue. So if California were a separate country, it would be in the top 10 of the world's biggest economic superpowers. Helping to run the state is no small task. And Jasmine, you know Bass personally. You mentioned her rise to speaker in your blog. Tell us a little bit about who she is.
Well, I'm very excited for her and for California because she is a great person. She's a great leader. When I worked in the California Assembly for the Honorable Mervyn Dimley, she was vice chair of the Legislative Black Caucus. She was and continues to be one of those people that is able to bring people together in terms of legislative issues. She was very focused. She was very tenacious. And she got in there, and she actually did what politicians should do. She got in there, and, you know, I remember one of the first things about her was she was putting out legislation back to back to back to back.
Jasmine, you know what? We're having a little trouble with your phone line. We are going to come back and talk to you more about this. So, you know, just hang in there. Eric, I'm going to bring you into this conversation. We're going to talk a little bit about Detroit in a bit. But this is this one of these situations where there are so many firsts? And in a way, Bass is following in the footsteps of Willie Brown, who was California's first black assembly speaker, period. He served at that post for 14 years, went on to become San Francisco's mayor in 95. California is not necessarily a state with the largest percentage of African Americans, but there's such a strong history of black leadership here. Why do you think that is?
Well, for one, I think that when you have an agenda that people can relate to, people tend to want to be a part of what you're trying to do. And a testament to her is the fact that she was just elected in 2004, and already she's the, or will become, the House Speaker, and that says a lot about her. Maybe her age had a lot to do with it. She is a very seasoned individual with regard to a working background, and that helped her to probably get a lot of people to coalesce with her agenda and to feel that she would be the mature type of person to get her to where she is now.
John, when you think about these state issues, I mean, states are, they can be their own superpowers, like California. It's such an enormous economic engine. And a lot of people don't really know what goes on the assembly level, but it's obviously critically important. Is this really the kind of job where, although it may not be as flashy as a Barack Obama running for president, people should look up and say, well, okay, this is a benchmark of progress on sharing political power in America? Is this something we should be plugged into?
Well, certainly it's big because California is so huge. And I definitely appreciate the comparison between, you know, Barack Obama, what he's doing on the national stage, and what Ms. Bass is undertaking, you know, there in California. Because, yeah, California is gigantic. But, you know, for my money, you know, enough with the first. You know, look at the love that Barack Obama is getting. And, you know, it's not so much about Mrs. Bass's color. I mean, we rattled off quite a few accomplishments. Jasmine was rattling off quite a few accomplishments that Ms. Bass has achieved. And so it's more about simply what she brings to the table, no matter what color she is, because we can go on and on and on about the first black person to do this, that, and the other. But I think we're getting beyond that now.
Jasmine, do you think it's a situation where we're kind of done with the firsts, or should we be done with the first? And then aside from that, what do you think the biggest challenges are going to be for someone in her position, specifically the position of speaker?
Well, the biggest challenges, I'll start with that one, is obviously just looking at California's deficit. I mean, right now we are sending pink slips to teachers. We are in a financial crisis, so she does inherit that, you know, but I don't think we're done with looking at first. I mean, there are still a lot of things that African Americans have yet to obtain. I mean,
She obviously is the first African-American woman, but we still have a lot more to do, especially in the political arena. And I just find it very inspiring that, you know, given all the diversity of California, and, you know, we don't have, in the legislature, in the 80-member assembly, we do not have very many African-Americans up there. So she had to be able to work with and garner the support of whites, Latinos, and Asians to be able to be voted as speaker. And I think that speaks a lot about who she is as a person in terms of being able to bring people together. And I think she'll be able to do that for California.
Eric, let me move on to something that is near and dear to your heart, no doubt. The Detroit mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, can't seem to shake his latest trouble. Over the past few months, he's been involved in a public scandal around intimate text messages that he exchanged with a woman who is not his wife. And it's boiled over into a police cover-up allegation, and a city council panel is moving to oust the mayor. You've been watching this story really closely. Catch us up to speed on what the recall movement and the city council approach is regarding the mayor right now.
Well, the city council's approach right now is to have a resolution passed. They will be voting on a resolution tomorrow. There are 9 members on the Detroit City Council. There needs to be at least 5 for the resolution to go forward. And what they are trying to do is trying to get the governor of the state to relieve him of his duties, because they don't have the power to do that unless he is convicted of a crime and found to be guilty of that crime. And it is having an effect on the city already, because you have the National Council of Black Mayors. They have pulled out of Detroit for their convention next month.
That's a very profound statement. Do you think that it's just essentially repudiating the city until the city is a symbol for good governance?
Oh, definitely, because the leader of that group, he gave the reason for them pulling out of the convention here in Detroit, which was supposed to take place, I think, the middle of April. He specifically said because of the troubles the mayor is having, that's why they decided to go elsewhere, and they would be going to New Orleans, Louisiana. And that's a testament to the lack of effectiveness the current mayor has in Detroit right now. You have people taking money out of the city that the city so dearly needs, that's a sign that it's time for him to go. Originally, I was not for him resigning. My thing was let everything play out. But when it starts to affect the city, a city that is in dire straits of the need to have money come into the city and be spent in the city, have people invest in the city, that's a problem. And I don't have faith in the electorate in Detroit to not do the right thing in 2009.
Well, you know, Mr. Brown, I think it says a lot about, you know, the folks who are in power, that once they get there and something like this happens, you know, they want power so much that they'll just cling and hang on until the very end, when, as you pointed out, man, this thing is affecting the city.
Correct.
You know, if the laws aren't in place, then the laws need to be changed, that, you know, to get this kind of stuff out of there. I mean, the sex stuff is bad enough as it is. And, you know, even as bad as that is, I would even argue that, hey, maybe that's not the reason for him to step down. But when it's just so much corruption and cover-up going on, I mean, that's just not good. And, yeah,
right.
the sex stuff is bad, point blank.
And the story that was done on Nightline last week, I mean, that really put everything into perspective with people around the country, because a lot of people may not have been aware of this, but a lot of people did watch Nightline last Wednesday or Thursday. And the comments that are on the Nightline website right now, I mean, if you are from Detroit, you should be ashamed to say or tell anyone you're from Detroit.
And see, the thing is, you know, we talk about, you know, the first black person to do this, first black, and Kwame is not, but it just shows you that, hey, you know, let's not put too much stock in the first black or having a black person in a certain position when you're not going to hold up and represent like you need to.
Jasmine, let me throw you into this mix. That's something that comes up again and again. It's like, are you down with the Brown just because of loyalty, or do you need to hold people to as high or even a higher standard? I mean, black elected officials are always going to be scrutinized closely from outside and inside the community. In a case like this, what's the responsibility of the voters?
The responsibility of the voters is to obviously do what they need to do to move the city forward. And it sounds like the mayor needs to go. It sounds like he stopped serving the public interest, is now serving his own personal interests. We always have to hold our elected and public officials accountable. I think you're seeing a nationwide movement of that with CBC members who are trying to support Clinton, even though their districts have said, hold up, no, we want Obama. And they're being, you know, called out for that, and rightfully so, because the districts, their constituents who they were elected to represent, you know, is the voice that they should be listening to. And the same goes here. While I don't know too much about what's going on in Detroit, it sounds like I said, he's serving his own personal interests. And we've had a situation or two like that here. Compton and Linwood come to mind, you know, where we've had sort of the same situation going on.
Well, if you want a point for right,
please go ahead.
The thing is, it's not about the text messages. It's not about the sex and cheating on his wife. For me, it's about the fact that he tried to have a secret deal to prevent this information from becoming public. That's what I have a problem with.
Which is no different from our federal government, right? And when we found out that our federal government was doing that with certain things as it related to the war and other things, you know, all hell broke loose. And we demanded that certain files be, you know, open so we could find out what's going on. So, again, it sounds like this man really needs to go.
Correct.
But, you know, look what we have here, the infidelity, the text messages and all that kind of stuff. You know, the secret deal is one thing, but then you marry that with, you know, the infidelity.
Bill Clinton, we had President Clinton. I don't think that's a reason to oust an elected official. But when you talk about cover-ups in the millions and millions of dollars and things of that sort, I think that's when it's time to reanalyze and figure out whether a person
No. Point taken. But my thing is, you know, if you put those two together, you see clearly the type of person that you're dealing with, the type of person who will try to make a sweet deal, a backroom kind of deal, is the kind of person who was doing these other things on the side.
All right, guys, I want to move us.
$9 million that they did not have.
I want to move us on to one last topic, but first of all, in case anyone's tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're talking with Jasmine Kanick of jasminekanick.com, Eric Brown of the Detroit News' political and government blog, and John McCann, who runs the blog Book of John. We were just talking about Detroit, and it sounds like there's plenty there, but I want to just take a quick journey to Neverland. Neverland Ranch, Michael Jackson. He has missed payments on a $24.5 million loan for his amusement park / ranch / boudoir. And the one question that comes to mind for me is, should his family, given that he has exhibited some unusual behavior, should his family have stepped in? Would anything have been different? Did they try? Jasmine, what's your sense of that?
I really don't know. I mean, are you talking about like a Britney situation where her father had to step in? I mean, the man is a grown man. You know, when I first, you know, heard the story, I thought to myself, well, okay, there are tens of thousands of other Americans out there who are missing payments on their home loans, too. That, you know, we're in a crisis right now in America. And I guess, you know, maybe, you know, he's not above that crisis either. But at the end of the day, it was probably poor financial, you know, management. If I had as much money as Michael had, I would not even be in this situation. But then on the second hand, I wouldn't even own a piece of property that big, not one that I don't visit either.
Well, John, the question becomes, I mean, many people have looked at the trials that he went through, regarding possible inappropriate behavior with children, all of the different issues that he's had over time. And you can't control another adult all the time, but there are checks and balances that often go around the lives of entertainers, you know, managers and other people who are trying to steer their ships. Is this a case where he just did what he was going to do, or do you think other people maybe even benefited from what sounds like poor decision making?
Well, first of all, cue up some sappy violin music for me now. I don't know about all.
You're
that.
Not sobbing for Michael.
No. Actually, I am. I'm disgusted. Hint. At Miss Jasmine, because listen, you know, this is just flat out wrong.
You're disgusted at me?
Yeah, because listen, this is Michael Jackson we're talking about here. Look at all this man has
done. You better
done
beat it.
For America. He gave us the moonwalk. He had us drinking Pepsi and wearing Jerry curls. The American people need to step up and respond and bail out.
The government need to bail him out, too?
We need to bail him out.
Okay. Yeah.
John, you
are alone on that
one.
On,
John, I think you're planning on performing on Def Jam next week.
You better beat it.
Stop hating on Michael Jackson, man.
I'm not hating on him. I say I agree with Jasmine. He's a grown man. I have brothers and a sister. If I'm not aware of their financial situation or if they don't let me into that situation, it's hard for me to get in a position to help him out because he seems to have more people that do not look like him around him more so than his own family.
Uh-oh.
So, bam, there you have it.
Except when he got into legal trouble, then he had
definitely
the
fruit
of Islam.
Definitely wanted to come home. He wanted to be, he wanted to be Michael Leroy Jackson. But bottom line
exactly,
is, you deal with your people the way you want to deal with your people, and I don't have any sympathy for him. Not when you have that much money.
I agree. When you have that much money, this is just absolutely ridiculous for him to be in this sort of situation. And maybe they'll teach him a lesson, maybe it won't. Regardless of the fact, he will still be Michael Jackson. I'm sure he will still put out albums. But, I guess it just goes to show you that even with all the money in the world, you can still have problems. I mean, look at Britney, look at Michael, look at all of these celebrities who are sort of in this sort of financial trouble.
All right, on that,
same situation.
We're going to have to end it there. More money, more problems. Thanks, guys. We've been talking to Jasmine Canick, political commentator who blogs at jasminecanick.com, Eric Brown, who blogs for the Detroit News' political and government blog, and John McCann, who runs the blog Book of John. And that is our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.